Third and last case for today, 92AP3208D, Board of Attorney Professional Responsibility versus David Jennings. Representing himself and arguing on his own behalf is Mr. Jennings, David B. Jennings III. Mr. Jennings.
Yeah, and if it pleases the court, I was here this morning and I watched the other proceedings. And one of the things I learned, or relearned, of course, is that this court reads the briefs, and I need not repeat those items that are in the briefs. I found this morning very interesting, very educational, and as I said, instructional. I also know that this court has heard long beyond your normal time period these cases, so again, I intend to be brief. As I read it in our appeal, my appeal, there really are three issues. Whether or not I've established that I have the moral character to practice law, whether the resumption of the practice of law will not be detrimental to the administration of justice or subversive of the public interest. Those are conclusions. The third is the recommendation of the trustee that until such time as I've been able to pay back all of the restitution that I owe and repay my former law firm all of the money that they may have expended, that I should not be permitted to return.
How much is still owing, Mr. Jennings?
Well, that's unclear. In the court, in the federal court ordered restitution, the balance is, as of the hearing in June, was under $10,000. I make payments, as the referee found, every 2 weeks out of my income. Additionally, any time that I received a brokerage commission, I made a payment. In addition to that, it's under $10,000. I'm going to say $8,500. The amounts that may be owed to my former law firm are not so clear. The law firm, at the time that I withdrew from the practice in July of 1992, I had receipts that had been earned at that point in time. $285,000 was what was accounted for. It's in the record. There's documents to that effect. I had one major case that I was working on. The last trial that I had was a foreclosure on the Milwaukee Center in Milwaukee. It was a $110 million foreclosure. I had more than $100,000 of fees accrued in that case. I did fly with Hugh Brown, my then partner, to Texas to make sure that we could conclude the case, and I know the fees were subsequently paid. I don't know how much. All of the fees that were earned, plus the draw that I had at that time, plus any additional fees, were retained by the firm as well as whatever value, if any, my partnership interest had. That's never been looked at. It's never been determined. It is clear that I have not had the economic wherewithal to pay them any amounts. I provided them with financial information every year and offered to give them anything more that they chose. But as the trustee found, based on my financial circumstances, I have paid the court order of restitution and also paid my taxes. A long answer to your direct question.
But is your objection that you really made significant, substantial restitution, or is your position that even if you haven't made substantial restitution, that you shouldn't be kept out of the practice of law because you're not wealthy?
I think that I have made substantial payments. I sold in 1997 everything that I owned, all the real estate that I owned, which was owned as joint tenants with my then wife. Everything we had was converted and it was paid over. And it was significant. Now, there's also dispute because that was about $250,000. That money was contested, and my father and my mother's trust also received proceeds of that sale. And as the brief addresses, that was something that was negotiated among their various lawyers. I was not party to that.
I was under the impression that you had $397,000 yet unpaid to your firm insurance carrier in DSI. And I'm looking for that number now. Does that sound about right, or does that sound wrong?
That is a statement that's made. Let me address that. The original federal court restitution order was $590-some thousand. When my law firm settled, back up for a minute too, I had, after this occurred in 1992, and there was an action commenced almost immediately against me and my law firm in the federal bankruptcy court, my client's case. I had answered the complaint without denying the conversion claims. No judgment was ever taken against me. In June of 1993, at a status conference, I brought into the court my offer of judgment and consent to judgment format, and it was entered at that time in the amount of $550,000. Subsequently, in 1994, the firm settled with the bankruptcy estate for a total of $500,000, $350,000, $175,000 from the firm's malpractice carry and $175,000 from the firm, in addition to a contribution from development specialist Bill Brandt of $150,000, constituted that settlement. The $397,000 figure would be $550,000 less the $152,000 roughly that was paid to the firm and the insurance company out of the sale of the real estate proceeds.
What do you think Judge Boelke missed?
Not much.
Well, that's why I asked the question, because, you know, he looked at everything, he heard you, he heard witnesses again you, and then he said, don't reinstate.
He did. I think what he missed is everything that has happened in the last 10 years. I think that's the most significant point that I can make, is that for the last 10 years, the specific items, and you can go down the line, the mortgage that was granted to my parents in September of 1992 when I thought we were going to have a settlement that's documented and referenced in the record. The statements to tax authorities regarding the taxability or the fraud enhancement, all these different things that he referenced occurred in 1992, 1993, 1997, 1998. And if I didn't do everything I should have done, some of which I've conceded, in those years, everything that I've done since shows good character. I had no control over the mortgage to my parents, and I think, as I've said in the brief, it had nothing to do with how the settlement proceeds were ultimately split up. I conceded in 2000, we had a hearing on my first petition for reinstatement, and I conceded that the failure to have continued making the monthly payments to the federal court system was wrong, was in error, and was not exemplary conduct. I acknowledged that, and I withdrew my petition at that point in time, and I withdrew it. Legally, I could have refiled it within a week or two. Had it been denied, I could have filed another one in 9 months. I waited more than 5 years until I could come in to the system and once again and say, these were the criticisms. At that time, I was criticized for continuing to reside in Mequon. I don't reside in Mequon. There were child support arguments that I paid slightly more than 17% in child support for my son, even though my wife and I were not yet divorced. And we shared a house. I lived upstairs, she lived downstairs. But I think that the restitution part was probably the most important aspect of it. There has been no interruption of that, and everything that I've been able to do to pay additional amounts, I've paid that. And I think that's one of the most important parts. And I'm not saying that simply the passage of time and the failure to have committed another act of misconduct is adequate. I showed a significant change in conduct. Everything that I had done since that time, and as many things that I had done even up to that time, were to try to remedy the harm that I had caused.
Do you have an alcohol abuse problem?
Do Do I have an alcohol abuse problem? Not that I have ever considered as such, nor that anybody has ever diagnosed. I had one traffic citation for that, first offense. It's the only offense.
Driving under the influence.
Driving under the influence. It was one time. It was the only citation I've received in 40-plus years of driving. It was under circumstances that don't suggest an abuse. It was at the end of a 12-hour workday. I'd been up early. We had a special event. I came home. I thought I was done for the day. At that time, I was still residing with my wife. I was upstairs. She was downstairs. She called at 9:30 or 10 o'clock at night from the farm, her business, a mile away, that she needed help. And I got in the car, and I drove at a high rate of speed on a deserted country road. And, of course, I'd known that the sheriff's deputies park in a certain spot across the street, but I was in a hurry, and I got pulled over. No, I don't believe I have an alcohol problem. I was assessed after that as part of the program. There was no finding that there was any history of that. In fact, in serving the federal criminal sentence that I did, on intake at the federal camp, that's one of the first things that they look into to see if you have a problem, because there are special programs for that. So I don't believe there's a problem. And I didn't use that as an excuse nor anything else. I can say that the money that I took was not used to support a drug habit. I've never had any experience with that. Alcohol abuse, gambling, extramarital affairs, nothing like that.
What'd you do with it?
Spent it on farm activities, horses, trips, unnecessary items. Of course, money is interspersed. I'm sure it was paying other bills from time to time, mortgage expenses, personal expenses. But I don't think there's any question in the record that during that time period, I lived above my means. And rather than to cut back on expenses, I spent money that was not mine and that I stole. Since that time, I have lived within my means. I lived frugally. I went into this, and I think that Judge Volpe, clearly found. I submitted financial information that showed the details of every check that I write. I live responsibly. I live frugally. I live in a little apartment on the west side of Milwaukee. And out of all of my earnings, which are limited, I pay more than anyone has required that I pay toward the remaining Wisconsin tax liability and toward restitution. I have also spent money this last year after I paid back my employer who lent me the money to satisfy the federal tax obligations. I have used those funds to pay expenses for this matter.
What kind of plans do you have if you are readmitted to the bar?
What I have said in both cases is I would like to find an opportunity to work not as a solo practitioner, but rather with a group of lawyers or in a development firm, real estate development firm. Or I think there may be opportunities for me in a limited sense. There may be opportunities in government employment. I have background and skills where I could lend assistance in the federal court, in the bankruptcy system. There may be other opportunities for me in legal aid type opportunities. I have to get there first. I think clearly that if I were to be privileged to have a license again, the issue of management of somebody else's money is very easily controlled. I got in trouble because there were no controls in place other than my own responsibility. I have had unsupervised responsibility for more than 10 years for other people's money in my current and recent employment. And there's evidence to that effect. And also, Referee Volpe made a finding to that effect. I have daily fiduciary responsibilities. and that there has never been any instance of a failure on my part to properly administer somebody else's money. And for a long period of time, more than 10 years.
It seems to me that Referee Vokey was concerned perhaps with that you've made no payment to your former firm since 1997, that reflected on your character. Can you respond to that?
Yes, I can. Two things. I have been very carefully scrutinized, even though in 2001 I was released from supervision in the federal system. Every year I provide financials to the Office of the United States Trust, United States Attorney, to give them complete access to my financial circumstances so that they can adjust the minimum amounts that I have agreed to pay pursuant to a note while I was under supervision, and at the time of release, they review your financials, you sign another note. And I paid slightly more than the minimum amounts every single month. I also had been very carefully, my financials were scrutinized by the IRS in the connection with the compromise and with the Department of Revenue in connection with the compromise with the Department of Revenue.
Why do you pay a little more than you have to pay when your partners have had nothing since 1997?
I've offered them in numerous, and it's in the record, in numerous instances I've said, you tell me what you would like for me to do. And the only other thing that I have done is that I discovered, because I didn't think that I had any insurance policies on my life, I thought it had all lapsed and all been turned in and all. When I discovered that I had some life insurance policies that still had limited cash surrender value and had a death benefit, I had those policies converted to my former law firm. And I make payments on that every month.
I was under the impression, and I might be wrong, so please correct me, that no payments had been made to your former law firm since 1997.
I have not made any payments to the law firm since 1997. I have made payments on insurance that I have made them beneficiaries of. Correct. I have not made any direct payments to them. I have, the priorities have been pretty well set for me, but I have complied with that. I have made payments to the clerk of courts in the Eastern District of Wisconsin. And we're not talking about excessively over. Currently I'm under order to pay a minimum of $250, and I set it up, I've got it set as automatic payroll deduct. It's $260-some because there's 26 pay periods in the year as opposed to 12 months. So not a significant additional amount. I have not had the luxury of additional income. I have not. It's pretty close to the bone.
As Judge Vokey saw it, the question is, how is Mr. Jennings' moral compass? How is it?
I thought that it was very good. I practiced law for more than 17 years before this occurrence. There was never any complaint, either as to my honesty, integrity, or competency. Competency is really not an issue in this matter. Judge Vokey found, and everybody else has agreed, that I was a very competent attorney. Of course, that's part of the rub here. I should have known better. I'm sorry, does that respond to your question?
Yes, counsel, thank you.
Mr. Jennings, how will it look if this court reinstates you? The way things work is that after this argument, the court will go back into the corner conference room and vote one way or the other. But then after that, an opinion will be prepared. An opinion will be prepared that really sets out in detail all of the history that you bring to this proceeding. There have been a number of occasions when this court has been criticized for being too lenient to people who have violated ethical standards. So the opinion is going to lay out the whole history, and then what you'd like is the bottom line is that you're readmitted. How is that going to look to the bar, and just kind of help me with that?
Certainly, Justice Prosser, very appropriate question, and I will attempt to respond as best I can. There are precedents for, and I've cited references to other lawyers who have taken money from their clients, other lawyers who have committed crimes and have been reinstated, many of whom were never revoked, some of whom were suspended for limited periods of time. In my case, the amount of money was significant, but there's no amount of money that any lawyer should be permitted to steal from a client. That's an absolute. And there are other instances, the Taylor case in particular, where an attorney had not only stolen money from his clients and was revoked, although it was fought, after a period of time, and when he was in the process of attempting to have his license reinstated, and it was reinstated, he was revoked a second time during the revocation period. Now, the revocation, the second one, related apparently to other client theft matters and embezzlement that occurred before the first entry of the revocation order, but related to a criminal conviction that occurred after the first revocation. His period of revocation and before reinstatement was less than 20 years, but not by much, if I recall the facts in that case, the Taylor case, which I cited. Apparently, he had made very little or no successful efforts to pay down the court-ordered restitution, the Wisconsin Supreme Court-ordered restitution, to his former clients. Apparently, and it was excused by the trustee because he apparently didn't have the wherewithal to make those payments over that period of time. Distinguishing a case of a lawyer misappropriation, I have a hard time even saying it, misappropriation from their clients, are many cases of well-known and respected attorneys who have broken the law and are reinstated. As I said, in some periods, 2 years. My period of revocation is now in excess of 16 years. The order of revocation will be, in a few days, 16 years. What is also different is that lawyers have resisted the revocation or suspension. There was no question at the time. I was relieved, quite frankly, that it was discovered. I acted, and Judge Volke confirmed that I did all the right things. There was no hesitation or prevarication. I acknowledged my wrongdoing. The Board of Professional Responsibility was shortly thereafter noticed. I cooperated in every form and fashion that I could have. I served a fairly serious federal sentence, a good portion of which, however, I was permitted to do in community service as opposed to a federal camp. As indicated in response to a prior question, all of my property was sold. There are arguments about how quickly that happened and who else was resisting. There were other interests, but everything that I had was sold. I think those are distinguishing characteristics. I cited other cases where an attorney who was not revoked but was suspended for an extended period of time, Attorney Gilbert, hadn't paid much in the way of restitution, maintained her suburban lifestyle, and the victim of her overbilling or theft or the combination of those matters was living in a government-sponsored circumstance, and she was paying him out over a long period of time, 9 years or something like that.
Mr. Jennings, yes, I noticed that, and it's clear in the record, that after the detection of the misappropriation that you cooperated with your former partners. Have you had any discussions more recently with them? Because obviously one of the big issues here, seems to me, is the restitution. And Judge Volke obviously spent a lot of time talking about that and considering it. Have you or anyone on your behalf had any discussions with your former firm about what can be done to resolve this? Is there any kind of communication like that?
It's been mostly one way. As shown in the record, every year, as a minimum, I do provide them a financial update and a letter and offer to meet. And the offer of a meeting has been received and declined. The only other, and again, it was referenced and in the record, it was gone into at the time of the hearing, is Hugh Brown, who was one of my partners, who I saw at Jesu Church at Marquette after a funeral of an attorney that we both knew. Hugh tapped me on the shoulder, and we went to the side at the conclusion, and we talked, and he, frankly, he said, is there anything they can do, the firm, the members of my firm, to assist me? Not all former members of the firm feel that way. So that's the nature of it. I have offered, and also unilaterally, the insurance I came up with on my own. Okay, they didn't ask for it. I just did it.
The $300,000, the over $300,000 number is what was reported. But you think, how much do you think is owed to the former firm?
If it's a dollar, it's owed. I don't know how much. Okay. It's significant, and it's beyond my current ability to pay. And whatever number you take, as I discussed with Judge Volke, if you take that number and I take half of my disposable earnings, it'll take me 33 years to pay them. And if that's the result, that's the result. It's beyond my current ability. My time is up.
Are there any other questions of Mr. Jennings? Mr. Jennings, thank you for appearing. Mr. Saline, the Office of Lawyer Regulation, representing the Board of Attorneys Professional Responsibility.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. My name is Keith Saline. I'm representing OLR this afternoon. It's my pleasure to be here to argue OLR's position and the public interest in this case. OLR's position is that Referee Volke's report is appropriate. His findings of fact should be approved, conclusions adopted, and his recommendation accepted by the court and ordered. The referee's conclusions are reasonably based on the facts which are in the record. His reasoning and his conclusions is sound, it's reasonable, and although I understand the court reviews that de novo, the court should adopt his reasoning based on its merit. The issue in this case relates to the standards in Supreme Court Rule 22.31 and the burden of proof required by that rule for any petitioner to prove by clear, satisfactory, and convincing evidence several items. In this particular case, the ones that are most apropos are that he or she has the moral character to practice law in Wisconsin, that his or her resumption of the practice of law will not be detrimental to the administration of justice or subversive of the public interest, and that his or her representations in the petition, including the representations in Rule 22.29 sub 4, are substantiated. Referee Volke properly applied this standard, and the burden of proof that goes with it. And in his findings and recommendations, he made that clear, that his decision was because of the burden of proof. He wasn't trying to say anything negative about Mr. Jennings, but he said, balancing all the testimony, all the proof that I've heard and read, there's a failure, in my opinion, to meet the standard of proof.
Counsel, what should have been presented to Mr. Volkey if that burden of proof were to be satisfied in your view?
Your Honor, there are several things that I would like to bring to your attention in that regard. First of all, you may recall from the reinstatement cases of John Carroll that there had been some concern in the underlying matters with that attorney about the handling of funds. And the opinion in the first reinstatement case, which I believe is 2004, Wisconsin 19 in the electronic site, and is also in our briefs, indicated that proof of proper handling of funds would be appropriate. In the reinstatement petition that Mr. Jennings had filed in the 1990s late and withdrew earlier, he had testified about some of that and had presented some witnesses about that. But at the hearing that we had in June, he did not present his current supervisors with his employment to talk about several things relating to the handling of funds, to confirm their opinion of his trustworthiness in testimony on the record. Second, to describe the degree of fiduciary responsibility he had and the degree of trust that had been placed in him in his duties there. This testimony, I think, is part of the failure of proof that OLR and I think the referee properly looked to. Although I will admit that I don't see in Referee Volkey's findings that he commented on that particular point.
Were they advised of this hearing, the supervisors?
OLR did not do that, Your Honor, no. Mr. Jennings did present several witnesses, and when you look at the transcript, and I think you'll see some information about this, and in addition with some of the letters and references, that would give you, I think, good reason to understand why Referee Volkey would not have given them more weight. And in my brief, in particular, page 13, I reference you to Mr. Brandt's testimony about moral character in the transcript itself. It's at page 67, lines 1 through 13. And without reading that for you again, Mr. Brandt's evaluation of moral character would make sense only if the partners had stolen the money and Mr. Jennings had attempted to reimburse the money. And so it would have been reasonable for Referee Volkey not to give that much weight on the issue of moral character. Attorney Emile Banks testified at the hearing, and he did testify regarding the moral character, but as you can see from his testimony on the record in the transcript, pages 105 and 106, he was not aware of the voluntary additional family support that Mr. Jennings had provided after the embezzlement came to light, or the embezzlement, preference in the Mequon property that had occurred after the embezzlements had come to light.
How long ago did those acts occur, Counsel?
They occurred in the late 1980s, and they were discovered in July of 1992.
Thank you.
There are several who testified at the district committee hearing in the prior reinstatement action and who provided letters of support in this action. And just to give you an example or two of some of the reasons why Referee Volkey might not have given them appropriate weight and should not. William Ladewig, for instance, a law school classmate, in his letter, he says two things about moral character. First of all, I cannot determine what moral character he currently has. And then later in the same letter, I believe he does now have a moral character. And so it's just not a clear statement that's unambiguous about his view of it. J. Dennis Thornton, someone who I believe may also have been a law school friend, conclusion without any supporting information. And again, I would highlight that the original Carroll reinstatement, the first one where it was denied, the court made some comments about testimony of the witness without examples or supporting information to bolster the value of that kind of recommendation. Several of the other letters of recommendation were from individuals who were doing business with him, as patrons or customers at the Furniture Clearance Center who spoke very favorably of them, but again, that kind of information doesn't rise to the same level as what a supervisor.
Christine, doesn't it seem like the big issue in terms of Judge Volke's decision, I'm looking at a copy of a transcript where he says, quote, I don't think that the license should be returned until such time as the victims are made whole. Doesn't, for all the talk about, you know, what constitutes proper evidence of moral character, doesn't that seem like the main consideration in this case is the large amount of the outstanding, large amount of the original theft, and then apparently the substantial amount of what appears to be the outstanding debt to the former law office?
Thank you, Justice Gableman. There are a couple of responses that I think are appropriate to your question. First of all, there's no doubt in the record that Referee Volke was concerned about that. Second, I think that the comment he made there is part of his rationale on his conclusions of law. But in the transcript where he makes his recommendations and his findings, he talks extensively about these other issues of moral character and whether resumption of practice would be detrimental to the public interest. And quite honestly, he spends much more time discussing that.
But you have to agree, though. It's, the reason, I'm not trying to debate you, it just seems like that seemed to be the sine qua non for Judge Volke, because in no other instance does he say, for all the other discussion of all those other considerations, in no other instance did I see where he said, well, until this happens, I don't think the law license should be given back. He doesn't say that except for the restitution.
Your Honor, I can't get into his mind to fully answer your question. I do understand the point you're making.
I'm just going by the transcript. I don't have any insight into Tim Volke's mind either, but that you don't have, other than the transcript.
The final response I would offer to your concern is that what happened in the underlying case is something that is relevant in consideration of moral character. What happened before it was discovered and before the revocation occurred. And in addition, as Referee Volke indicated in his reasoning in the opinion, the response that Attorney Jennings had from 1992 through 1997 and 1998 is also relevant on the issue of what is his moral character. And those things are properly considered.
Wasn't for 27 months, wasn't he incarcerated? And wouldn't his ability to pay be hindered?
That's true, Your Honor. And I'm not trying to imply that OLR would say that an inability to pay should preclude reinstatement. I mean, that's not OLR's position here. OLR would not adhere to the sine qua non nature of that statement. And we don't think that you should either.
It just seems to be, I think conservatively said, one of the major factors in this, in the factual background of this matter.
Your Honor, in his mind, as he stated it, it seems clear. The evidence in the record would indicate that after the embezzlement was discovered, that there were preferences given. And Referee Volke made findings of fact regarding that. And so I think there is some appropriate concern that this court should have that and should find that Referee Volke found reasonable regarding the extent of control Mr. Jennings would have had regarding restitution at a time when he was able to influence it, and his actions during that time period.
Well, let's take a look at, in part, what Referee Volke did. And I have the transcript in front of me. And it looks like, at least to me, I'm going to go kind of quickly, on page 221 of the transcript, he talks about the law firm is still the victim. The original restitution was $590,200, and the law firm, its constituent members, are still owed $397,680. So that's one point he's making on page 221. He notes a little later on that same page that in the early 90s he was revoked for probation was revoked because of his failure to make payments. He notes on that page there was evidence that Mr. Jennings put his parents in a position as preferred creditors over other victims. He notes that he can understand family is number one, but that might not be fair, and that it gives an idea of what his moral compass is. On the next page, on 222, he says, as late as 1998, Mr. Jennings maintained that the stolen funds were loans and not subject to income tax, and that really bothered me because it's after the revocation of his license. So that apparently was bugging the referee. The referee on page 222 says, I don't give much credence to the OWI, so that's one factor he didn't consider. On page 223, he does consider the criminal conviction and the time served. And he also says on 223, but the other issue has to do with the privilege of having a license to practice law, and it's a privilege, and that he wants reinstated. He notes OLR's position is against reinstatement. That's on 223, 224. He says that although I was reading through everything and listened to testimony, is what is the difference between 1999 and now, and I don't see any difference. Nothing has changed, and that appears to me to be kind of a relevant factor in his consideration. And on that same page on 224, he indicates it's not hard enough. It's not enough to be hardworking. It's not enough to be articulate, although, well, yeah, that should get you to at least first base. It's not enough to be capable of providing terrific services to clients. He goes on to talk then on the next page, a number of things. On 225, at towards the end, he says, in the bottom line, Mr. Jennings, is I'm just not satisfied with the evidence that you've got the moral compass, which I think is necessary to practice law. I can't find, based on the evidence, that Mr. Jennings' conduct has been exemplary and above reproach since revocation. I can't find that he's met the burden of proof, or that he has, continuing on the next page, 226, a proper understanding or attitude towards the standards that are imposed upon members of the bar. I can't find that Mr. Jennings can be safely recommended to the legal profession. Balancing everything, he says on page 226, that I've heard and read is a failure, in my opinion, to meet the standard of proof. Goes on to talk about the standard of proof. And ultimately, at the very end, at the last paragraph on page 227, where the hearing is adjourned at 3:15, he says, I don't think the license should be returned until such time as the victims are made whole. And additionally, it's my recommendation that he pay costs and fees. So, I don't know, I may have missed something beforehand, but those seem to be the basis of his rationale in this case. What else is there that I missed in going through highlighting, if you're able to respond to that? Maybe you weren't listening.
I'm not sure that I included or excluded.
I didn't jump over a lot of text that seemed to be just supporting those main points.
He wasn't. Could you repeat the question?
Let me start then, if you will.
Your Honor, I think that fairly covers his reasoning, obviously, yes.
Nothing else. That's
the highlights that I would like to
read. I'm sorry. Did you talk about the fact that when he had his driver's license suspended, this is after driving under the influence, it was suspended because he failed to pay a forfeiture?
That's correct, Your Honor. And the referee.
It's like page 222.
Right. The referee mentioned in his findings, if I recall them correctly, not looking at them right now, that he didn't give much weight to the OWI conviction, but he gave some weight to the fact that the payment of the forfeiture was not made and his license was suspended. Yes.
Does he have a license now?
Your Honor, I'm not recalling right now whether he does. Right. I don't know.
When, under your view of this case, Mr. Saleem, when, if ever, will Mr. Jennings be able to get back his license?
Your Honor, it depends on the showing that he would make under 22.31. That's OLR's position.
And,
that's the court's policy.
And you said, if I heard you properly, that he had to show that he is currently able to handle funds. And he didn't. He says he showed it because he's been in a supervisory position, managing, is it furniture stores?
Yes, Your Honor.
Managing, okay. You say, but he didn't bring in his supervisor.
Right, Your Honor. I understand the testimony of his handling of funds since 2000 to be his testimony, which Referee Volkey did not say he discredited per se. On the other hand, he did say that in all, Mr. Jennings did not meet his burden of proof.
Okay.
And I think
so. If he brought in a supervisor who said, so we check him out, he handles X amount of money per year, per month, per day. I've never had any trouble with him since 2000 or whatever. That would be at least a step.
Yes, ma'am.
Do you require that he pay back his partners?
Your Honor, the court's policy on restitution is very clear. The court strongly encourages restitution. The court has not denied reinstatement solely based on an inability to pay.
No, because we've had people pay back large sums of money in small sums.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so that, the fact that he hasn't paid restitution does not do that. Okay.
But then he hasn't paid restitution in full.
Full. He's paid some restitution. All right. Then we have the failure to pay the forfeiture, right?
Yes.
So we'll see if he has paid the forfeiture and whether he has a license or whether he took the badge of bus here.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I do recall he paid the forfeiture.
Ultimately?
Yes.
Okay.
And promptly upon suspension.
What else can he show, in your opinion, that would persuade you to stand up for him before a referee and say he has a moral compass?
There are a couple.
Pointing north, I assume.
There are a couple of things, Your Honor, that would be helpful in that regard, in addition to that. First of all, although not specifically found to be a problem by Referee Volkey in the way he expressed it in his findings, there was evidence at the hearing regarding Mr. Jennings' statements to the tax authorities regarding the nature of his embezzlement. And we discussed that both at the hearing, and Mr. Jennings addressed it also in his brief at page 11. It's been 16 years since this occurred. There's no longer any reason for any rationalization about what that was anymore.
You're talking about loans?
Versus the thefts in his statement.
Versus the thefts and the tax offenses
right
for loans versus.
That's right, Your Honor. And that, in OLR's mind, indicates that something that reflects adversely on moral character in regard to the fact that there has to be an unequivocal recognition in all of you that what happened was what happened. And it was wrong. He has admitted what he did was wrong. But with regard to this particular aspect of it, we still argue about it, even at the hearing in the briefing cycle. We're still rationalizing what this was, why it was done. There's no reason for that anymore. So that would be something that would be important, that would be helpful. I think the information we talked about before, about his responsibilities and the level of trust, the level of responsibility is very important. And without that, it's very hard to properly assess whether he is safely entrusted to the public to practice law. And so I think that's something that's very helpful to have. There are some other things that could occur that are suggested in some of the court's previous opinions relating to burdens of proof on reinstatement. Mr. Taylor, in particular, there are two important things. He had made a showing that was much stronger than the showing in this case regarding the nature and the character of the recommendations, regarding his public voluntary service that he had been performing for many years. And something that was also very important is the referee's personal evaluation of the petitioner in the Taylor case and in some other cases where reinstatements have been granted was very favorable. And in this case, we see Referee Volkey's considered evaluation was not favorable. That's something that I think the court ought to consider a very weighty matter, and has consistently in its opinions.
As I recall, OLR opposed reinstatement.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So we're here now talking about the record and whether or not the burden of proof has been met at this hearing. was more than just the burden of proof. I mean, what were the major concerns for OLR? Are those what you just responded to the chief, that is, that it's not owning up to what he embezzled, wasn't really a loan in part, and still maintaining that fiction? Is that the major thing? What causes OLR to object to reinstatement in here? Because then, I don't know, you were talking about burden of proof when you were taking your position, that is, in other words, there was no burden of proof by clear satisfaction or convincing evidence necessarily, anyway.
Your Honor, I think the best way to summarize that is really to just go over the highlights when you went over his opinion, some of the things that were in my notes from his findings and his reasoning were these. That the main issue in this case was how is his moral compass. And so he's looking very carefully at that particular element of 2231. He distinguished that from the technical abilities, which no one disputed, that he had very good technical abilities. He looked at the fact that there were some victims who were still victims, and he looked at the fact that there were some preferences that had been made when he did that. He made very careful consideration of the nature of the underlying misconduct that occurred, that was the basis of his revocation. That is something that this court has consistently held as being relevant to an evaluation of moral character on reinstatement. Referee Volkey looked very carefully at what happened after it was discovered and after he had been revoked, and that's something that is very carefully, ought to be very carefully considered, and it's even part of the additional rule in 22.29, and he made some findings of fact relating to those things. Regarding the underlying conduct, he was impressed by the amount. He was impressed by something that was not apparent at the time of his original revocation, the thefts from his mother's trust, and he made some comments in his recommendations about how he responded to that as the referee. The vulnerability of the bankruptcy clients, the harm to the partners, the use of the money, that all those things went into it. He made reference to the pattern of conduct, that this was something that occurred over 40 months. It was happening regularly, and it involved monthly reports to DSI and Mr. Brandt and ultimately to the bankruptcy court that were false in order to cover things relating to the underlying misconducts. Regarding the subsequent misconduct, he made a point that victims were still victims. The family, in some regard, is still a victim. Mr. Brandt, although he seems to be one who has forgiven and moved on, and Referee Volkey took that certainly into consideration, still a victim. The law firm is still owed some money, a large amount of money, which we've talked about. There's the issue of the probation revocation since his revocation and the issues there. There's the matter about the preferences for the creditors, things that have been fully briefed, I believe, and you have that information for you. So there are a lot of things that concerned OLR, Your Honor, just to summarize, that went into this that we thought raised those issues about whether he could meet the burden regarding proving moral character. And those things were certainly presented at the hearing on both sides and considered by the referee.
Are there any other questions for Mr. Saleem? Mr. Saleem, do you have anything else you want to say?
At this point, Your Honor, I don't think there's anything else I need to say. I'm happy to respond to any further questions that the court would have.
Thank you very much, Mr. Saleem. Mr. Jennings?
Let me first respond to an inquiry that the Chief Justice made about this traffic citation and the civil forfeiture. I had paid all of the expenses associated with that. You pay fees to get evaluated. You have to pay, you know the. And I was making my monthly payments, and not intentionally, but I believed, and I testified to this, that I had made the payment. It was missed. I discovered it, and within days, the unpaid forfeiture was paid.
You have a driver's license?
Yes. I had my driver's license. I needed it to get to work, among other things. I had my driver's license reinstated within days, and it's never been at risk since that time, and I did not drive when I did not have the license. And certainly I wish that never happened, but I think that's
side issue. I don't think it has to do with moral character. It cost me something, and I could have taken the money to send to my law partners, but I didn't pay medical bills instead. All of the items that OLR currently criticizes, with the exception of the traffic citation that occurred in most recent, all of those items were also addressed in the first, in the hearing on the first petition. And they were all listed. And I've addressed all of those items, each and every one of them. It is true there's still a substantial amount remaining, and primarily to my former law partners. Mr. Brandt has testified that he'd never expected any repayment of the $150,000 that he contributed, and he has no legal right to it, apparently, if you follow the idea that the judgment that the bankruptcy estates had has been assigned to the law firm. The $550,000 judgment, less the monies that they received, is what the law firm has a legal right to hold. And I've never contested that. I just don't have the wherewithal to do that. As far as the statements to the tax authorities, again, we're repeating something, and it wasn't characterizing everything as a loan. It was a mischaracterization nonetheless, and the last time that happened was in 1998. I withdrew the objection, acknowledged the responsibility to pay the tax, entered into a compromise, and those taxes have been paid down significantly, and I pay them every month. As far as Taylor case and distinguishing that, as Director Saleen said, there was reference to, that he had performed some public service, and there's reference in the case here, too. I concluded a commendation. I've donated gallons of blood over a period of time. I do that on a regular basis. I do other things. Again, if there's any other questions, I think the record is fairly clear. I would be happy to respond.
Are there any questions for Mr. Jennings?
Have the thought occurred to you, Mr. Jennings, to ask your current employers to come to the hearing?
Thank you very much, because that was addressed. While it may have occurred to me, it wasn't readily available, and there didn't seem to be any issue after receiving the report from the OLR that there was any question that in my employment for the current employer, which is a 150-year-old company and has a great reputation in the state of Wisconsin, there had never been any question about my job performance and the duties that I had, neither in the OLR report nor in the course of the hearing. I had produced witnesses from my then employer in 2000, which was also the Porter Furniture Company. My immediate supervisor did testify on my behalf, as well as another supervisor from the prior company that I'd worked for. And I think the history has spoken for itself. There had never been any suggestion. Had I realized that that was an issue and it hadn't been previously, I'm sure I could have gotten several of them. In fact, Bob Waters, who's the owner of the Porter Furniture Company, who I work for, he's my boss, he's in his 80s, he offered to. He also acknowledged he's not very eloquent and he doesn't like these sorts of circumstances. But I think that's a great point. There's no checklist. We don't know what to do. And again, it may have been my duty, but it didn't seem to be an issue. And I don't believe it has been for now. Since 1995, I've been employed in a fiduciary responsibility, and there's never been a penny missing. And I think had that occurred, somebody would have said something. No other questions? Thank you so very much.
Mr. Jennings, for appearing. These are never easy cases for the court, and they're not easy for the respondents. We appreciate your courtesy and your effective argument today. Mr. Saleen, as always, we enjoy your presentations, if enjoy is the appropriate word. This concludes our hearing of 92AP3208D. The court will meet at 5 of 4.